This week's Parsha is Parsha Mishpatim. We're going to start on page 432. And this is going to be Perek Chaf Gimel Pasuk Beis. Perek Chaf Gimel Pasuk Beis. Lo Yisiach Rei Rabim L'Rois. Do not be a follow of the majority for evil. Lo Yisane El Riv. Do not respond to a quarrel. Lintois, acharei rabim lahatois, and do not respond to a grievance by yielding to the majority to pervert the law. Now, Rashi explains what that means is that do not basically follow the majority when they're trying to do something wrong. But this last phrase, acharei rabim lahatois, is the phrase by which this phrase is the source of following the majority when you're supposed to. You know, the fact that we have a rule that if you have a majority of, if you have a difference between judges, you follow the majority of the judges, comes from here. There are other issues of following the majority that also are derived from acharei rabim lahatos, to follow the majority. So there is a famous question that is brought down in many different sources, a question that may sound a little funny, but it's brought down, and it seems that it was not taken that lightly. So the story is told that a Gentile scholar, asked the famous Rabbi Nissen Eibeshitz the following question. If your Torah says to follow the majority, then why aren't you following us? Because we're the majority.
Majority of what?
Majority of people who are not believing in the Torah, majority of people that are believe in Christianity. So why aren't there's more people in Christianity than people believing in Judaism? So why aren't you following the majority? That was the question that was posed. The answer that he gave was the following. Consider the following situation. We have a halacha that says that if, let's say, you find a piece of meat outside on the ground, okay, and there are 9 kosher stores on the street and 1 not kosher store, and we have there's no identification. We don't know, you know, where did it come from? So the halacha is you follow the majority. If something came from a certain place and it left, and we don't know where it came from, we'll follow the majority. So the majority of stores are kosher, and therefore we can assume that this piece of meat is kosher. Because wherever it came from somewhere, the majority of where it could have come from are kosher, you're allowed to assume it's kosher. However, let's say the piece of meat is wrapped in a paper, and it's wrapped it has a seal on it, and you know, it's from Kelly's butcher shop. It's from, you know, O'Rourke's butcher shop, okay? What are you going to say then? Is it kosher or not? Are you going to say, well, the majority of stores are kosher, so we should say it's kosher? Are we going to do that then?
It's a siman.
Certainly not, because there we have no question where it came from. We don't have a question where it came from. The fact that it has this identification tells us, you know, it came from the non-kosher store. Basically, the point of this is to say that you follow the majority when you have a doubt, when you have a suffix. When you have a doubt, you follow the majority. If you don't have a doubt, because you just don't, there's no reason to have a doubt, you don't follow the majority. Even if the majority is telling you, would say the opposite, but if there's no doubt, then you don't follow the majority. So Rabbi Nissen Eibeshitz said back, we don't have any doubts about our belief. About the fact that Hashem gave us the Torah at Har Sinai, we have no doubts about that. And therefore, to say you follow the majority who don't believe in that isn't a question. Because you follow the majority when there's a doubt. When there isn't a doubt, you don't follow the majority. And we have no doubts. That was his answer. It's a halachic answer in the sense of understanding the law of following the majority, that law of following the majority is a law when there is a doubt. But if there is no doubt, you don't follow the majority. Now what's interesting is that this question was actually posed at an earlier point in time. Because there's a medrash that has this question. There's a medrash that has this discussion going on again between a Gentile and a rabbi. And the way it's brought down is the following. It's brought down in an interesting way. Okay. Give me a second. Let me just find it. So the Medrash in Parshas Vayikra, Perek Dalet, the fourth chapter, and this is, Perek Dalet, Beis, brings like this. Amar Rebbe Elasa, Rebbe Elasa said, Goy echad shal es Rebbe Yeshua ben Karcha. A Gentile once asked the sage Rebbe Yeshua ben Karcha, Kesiv b'tei rasam, it's written in your Torah, Achare Rabim Lahatis. You should follow the majority. Onu Merubim Mikem. We're more than you. Mipnei Ma'ein Atem Mashvin Imona Bavei Dezara. Why don't you become equal to us? Why don't you agree with us when it comes to Avodah Zarah? There's more people worshiping Avodah Zarah than you guys who are worshiping God. Omar Lo Yesh Lo Chabanim. So Rishon Ben Karcha said to the guy, do you have sons? Omar Lo Yizgatani Tzarasi. He said to him, oh, you've just mentioned my tzaras. You mentioned my sons, you're mentioning my headaches. Amalai lama, why? What's the problem? Amalai haibibarim yeshi, you have a lot of sons. B'shar shehen yoshven al sholchani, when they're sitting at my table together eating, zemavarech leloike ploini, one blesses the god of so-and-so, zemavarech leloike ploini, and the other one blesses another god, v'einam imdim isham, and they don't stand up and they don't leave the table until they bash each other over the head. You know, we think that was only between Republicans and Democrats, you know, that this problem has been around. This problem has been around not just around politics, but around this too, basically saying that each one has his own God, and each one, because of that, they get into fights all the time. So Rabbi Shuman Karcha said back to this Gentile, are you equal with them? Are you in agreement with them? Amar loy loy, he said no. Amar loy, Rabbi Shua ben Karcha said to this Gentile, at sha'ata mashva aysanu lecha, before you try to make us like you, hashve es banecha, get your kids in line. Before you try to get us in line with you, get your own kids in line. So nitchav alach loy, the guy walked away. Kevin Shayatza, once he left, Amar loy talmidav, so then the students of Yerushua ben Karcha said to him, Rebbe, Lazed achisa b'kana rotzitz. This one you pushed off with a broken stick. Meaning, you were able to push him off with a weak answer. What are you going to say to us? Meaning, they were saying to Rishua ben Karcha, yeah, you were able to get him out of the way, but you can't get it past us. What's the real answer? Amar lahem, be'es of ksiv be'sheish nefashis, uksiv by nefashis harbe. The ksiv ayikach esav es nashav es banav es benayisav es kol nafshis be'sai. By Esav, when the Torah uses the word, the souls of his household, it talks about souls in the plural. Ubi Yaakov shivim nefesh. When Yaakov talks about Yaakov's family of 70, it uses the phrase shivim nefesh, 70 soul. Uksivei nefesh achas. And it's written by him one soul. The chsivei he called nefesh sheitzayerech Yaakov. As it says, all the soul of those who came from Yaakov. Meaning Yaakov's children are not described as nefeshos, souls in the plural, but as nefesh in the singular. Esav, because he worships many gods, it says many souls. But Yaakov worships the one God. By him it is written one soul. Okay. So, we have to figure out what's going on here. You know, it seems that Rishu ben Karcha didn't answer the question. He just kind of pushed the guy off. Like, you know, get your own family in line before you start trying to get us in line. But on that, the Talmidim said, the student said, that's not an answer. What's the real answer? And the answer is, what a fact that by Esav it says in the Fashais, Esav is described as souls because he worships many gods, and Yaakov is described as Nefeshachas, one soul, because he worships one God. What's the back and forth here? What's the discussion going on here? So I'm going to share with you two explanations from the commentaries here in the Medrash. One is the commentary of the Mar Zu. One of the commentaries. And he says like this, and he really starts from a very, very basic point. And the basic point that he starts off with is that, you know, he says, if you would ask me, what is the answer to this question? The guy comes from Ben Karach and says to him, the Torah says, follow the majority, then why aren't you worshipping idols? That's the majority. So what's the simplest answer to give? The simplest answer to give is, well, if the Torah says, don't worship idols, then clearly the rule of following a majority doesn't apply. Doesn't apply there. If the Torah says, this you don't do, and this you don't do, and that you don't do, then the fact that means the Torah is saying, don't do it. It's basically, although there is an idea of following the majority, right, it clearly is not going to apply for where the Torah says, don't do this, don't do this, don't do that. It just doesn't apply. So that's the real answer, says the Mar Zu. The real answer to the question is the fact the question doesn't start. If the Torah says don't do it, then of course the majority rules doesn't apply to that. So therefore, but what he did when the guy asked him the question was he pushed him off. He pushed him off. He didn't want to get into a discussion with him. The student said, all right, look, you know, we understand what you didn't want to get involved with him, and we understand what your answer really is. But they said, there's a problem. The problem is the fact that we have something in the Torah where when you have two contradictory statements in the Torah, you need a third one to basically come and answer the contradiction. So we have something like that, said the students. We have the Torah saying, follow the majority, and we have the other parts of the Torah saying, don't do Avodah Zarah. So you seemingly have two contradictory statements. How do you take those statements that are contradictory seemingly and answer them when maybe here it says it's like two contradictory statements. Perhaps here it doesn't exactly fit that. But their point was, but you have two contradictory statements and there should be a way of how to answer that contradiction. And on that, the way the Mar Zu explains what Rishua ben Karcha meant to say to them was that they should understand that the answer that he gave to the Gentile is going to be an answer to their question also. The answer that he gave to the real answer that he that the real answer applies to them also. Meaning, the answer that he said is that the real answer is if the Torah says don't worship Avodah Zarah, then following the majority doesn't apply. So they say, okay, but it seems to be contradictory statements in the Torah. How do you answer the contradiction? So the way the Mar Zu explains the answer is, he says like this. He says, When do we say that you follow the majority? That's in a situation where you have a minority saying one thing, and the majority all comes together and agrees to one opinion. You're going to have an argument. There's two opinions, let's say, and the majority and the minority holds one opinion, and the majority together, the whole majority agrees to one opinion. Okay? And they disagree with the minority. That's when the Torah says follow the majority. But in the case of the Gentile who comes and says, why aren't you following the majority of people who worship idols? The answer is that the problem is that that majority aren't even in agreement of what to worship. Everybody has their different forms of idol worship. It comes out there's really no majority. It would be very hard to find a majority necessarily that's really agreeing to one thing. Just look at what we have right within Islam. You have different sects within Christianity. You have different sects, right? Where their fundamental beliefs are different. The fundamental beliefs are different. You know, in Torah, you have certain fundamentals that are all basic. Especially the idea of worshiping God and what is God. It's the same Torah. We have different interpretations, but I'm saying the fundamentals, especially regarding worshiping God, those fundamentals are the same. So therefore, in the way that he seemed to have pushed off the Gentile by saying, you have children, he says, oh, my children, every one of them has a different God that they worship, and they get into big fights about it. And then he said to him, well, straighten out your house before you try to straighten out us. In essence, what he was saying to the guy was, the same way your kids all have these different beliefs, that's exactly what makes it that we don't really have a majority of idol worshippers to say to us, why aren't you following us? Because the majority that we follow is a majority that's all in agreement. But a majority that's not even in agreement, you don't follow. And therefore, he says that, and therefore, I don't have two contradictions. It's not a contradiction of follow the majority, worship idols. There's no majority. And he doesn't necessarily, the Mazu does not explain exactly, when he answered them by talking about how Esav it says many souls, Yaakov it says one soul. He doesn't exactly go into that, like what was Rabbi Shua ben Karcha doing with that. But I think according to him, what he's doing is he's bringing it out with a drasha. But the point is that like it says, Esav has many gods. Has many gods, meaning even within Esav, you have those who worship this, those who worship that, but we have one God. That's why we're called Nefesh Achas, one soul. And therefore, because of that, there's no majority against us. So that's one way of explaining this Medrash. Now, another way of explaining the Medrash is the following. And that is, that again, the question that the Medrash brings down is, that a Gentile had asked Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, as we have in this week's parsha, we learned the rule of following the majority. So this Gentile said to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, us pagan worshippers, us idol worshippers, we're the majority, you're the minority, right? Your Torah says follow the majority, why aren't you following us? That was his question. So, it's an interesting question. As we mentioned, the Marzu's answer is really the simplest in the sense of, you don't follow majority when the Torah tells you certain things you don't do. Okay? But that would really be the simplest answer. But others seem to have taken this in a different direction of really trying to answer, of trying to deal with actually working as at the end the Marzu does, defines what following the majority really means, to say that according to the real understanding of what following the majority is, you're not going to go ahead and follow the majority that's doing the wrong thing. The commentary of Etz Yosef says in a little bit of a different way. He says like this. When the Gentile came and said to them, and said to him, the majority of people are worshiping Avodah Zarah idol worship, so you should be following the majority. What this Gentile meant to be saying to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, according to the commentary of Etz Yosef, is the following. As we have mentioned, I think we mentioned it last week, and that is that one of the main forms of worship, of idol worship, wasn't to say there's no God. It's to understand God created the world, God exists, God created the world, but it delegated everything out to his ministers. He delegated power to other creations to run the world. And it's because, and if you believe that, then you say that I have to worship the sun because the sun gives me what I need, and if I want him to give me what I need to worship him. The stars, whatever it is that you're worshiping, you're saying that this is a minister of God, but because it's a minister of God, I have to worship it, I have to give it honor to make sure it's independent, it's been given independent powers, and I need to worship it to make sure that it's going to take care of me properly. So therefore, basically, what the guy said to Rabbi Shua ben Karcha was, look, you know, we all believe in God. We all believe in God. It's just a question of, you know, his ministers. So why the majority feels that is following that, then why aren't you joining the majority? So Rabbi Shua ben Karcha's answer was basically So basically, the way I understand this H. Joseph is that, again, using his example of his kids, that all his kids had different beliefs in God, and they all got into fights about it, that basically, you know, if you believe in all these different, you know, these different officers, but if I understand the H. Joseph properly, and, you know, talking about the fight, right, if they're fighting, what are they fighting about? You know, the sun does this and the moon does that. I mean, everything has its job. What are you fighting about? The answer would seem to be, as I don't know if we mentioned it here last week, but I know in Shul somebody brought it up. I mean, the Rambam says it. And that is that the Rambam says, idol worship began with this idea of worshiping God's ministers. But it came to a point that people forgot about God. And it came to a point also that people started saying, no, it's the sun's in charge. The sun's in charge of everything. If you're a sun worshiper, you typically are not going to be a worshiper of the sun and the moon and something else, right? You become a sun worshiper. So even if you believe that God created the world, right, but he delegated power to the sun, the idol worshippers developed this kind of belief that he delegated everything to the sun and the sun is in charge. But another group says, no, it's the moon that's in charge. No, it's this that's in charge. It's that that's in charge. Which is why his kids got into this whole fight. And therefore, because this is what happens, there's no way to follow the majority. It makes no sense to follow the majority. Because basically, they're all fighting with each other, and they can't come to an agreement which one's in charge. So there's no point of following the majority. No one's in agreement, basically, to follow the majority. Similar to what we said before. All right. So then the students said to him, all right, fine. You gave him an answer, right? You gave him an answer to push him off, okay? But, you know, there's still another question that has to be asked. Which, the way I understand it is, yeah, you're right. It's pretty clear that you've got nations that, even if they believe that Hashem created the world, but they believe that he delegated power to something. Not to many things, but to something. And then we have all these fights, which one is the main one? But the students of Shua ben Karcha, okay, forget about that. Forget about choosing one. Don't choose one. Worship them all. Honor them all. Each one has his job. Each one has the thing that he does. So good. So again, you can follow. You could follow what would be what's officially called avodah zarah. And you know what? Don't do what they do, which is take one, which doesn't make sense, right? But rather, take them all, worship them all, give them all covet. They all have their jobs. Give them all covet. You know, you try to answer by saying there's no majority of who's in charge. But there is a majority that's saying that we should be doing something for Hashem's ministers. And therefore, if one way it doesn't make sense, all right, it doesn't make sense. Do it this way. Why isn't it? Do it this way. Do it this way. And if the majority would go ahead and agree with that, it would make sense to follow, wouldn't it? So his response back was, the way they Yitzhak says it is like this. Shuvas Rabbi Shua ben Karcha lahem. Being that each one is appointed over one thing, over one area, let's call it. And there's no one power that can run the entire world. It's not appropriate to worship any one of them. You can't have many different people, you know, running things. You can only have one. And therefore, you have to say that what they're appointed to do, they have have to do it. Meaning they're all, the ain biyadam l'shanes es tafkidem. They can't change. Meaning they're all not independent of Hashem. They're all doing exactly what Hashem wants, because they can't do otherwise. They're just Hashem's agents, Hashem's medium to do it. And therefore, there's no point of there's no point of worshiping them, but it's a point about worshiping Hashem. So let's try to put this together. The way that the Eitz Yosef says is that being that each one can't run the entire world, okay, therefore, there's no point of worshiping any one of them, because you can't have many leaders, you can only have one. And therefore, it's got to be that they're not acting on their own, but they're just doing exactly the will of Hashem. Okay, so what? How do we understand this line? He seems to be saying, you know, I mean, their question was, you know, they're different, you know, Hashem has delegated power to all these different agents, and therefore, maybe it would make sense to say, let's worship each one, give honor to each one. So he says, you know, if there's not one that can be in charge, then it doesn't make sense, then it's not appropriate to worship any one of them, because you can't have many leaders. I mean, why not? You know what I mean? As we spoke about last week, you could have the chief of staff, you could have the supreme commander, he delegates his generals, and each one has their independent power, and they do. Why can't that work? So, I'll suggest something. My suggestion is, what he maybe meant is that at the end of the day, you know, we know that there's a person in charge. Let's say in the case of the, you know, the supreme commander, and how does his generals, right? Does it always work? Doesn't always work, right? You talk about Patton, right? It doesn't always work. Imagine when you have a lot of them. Not just, you know, a couple of them. The more you have of them, right, the more chances are that things aren't going to go right. Well, the sun hasn't yet decided not to rise in the morning and not to set at night. It hasn't, you know, there are certain times where things don't work out the way we want it to, right? If you want to make an argument, but it works too well. It works too well to say that all these different things have all been put in charge of their area and they are in charge. It doesn't make sense. And therefore, the fact that it does always work the way it does, as well as it worked the way it does, is because of the fact that these are not independent powers, but just the mediums by which Hashem runs the world. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to worship any of them. Because they have no independence. They're not making decisions and have independence of what they can do and what they can't do. They're all just a medium of Hashem. They're all just following Hashem's command. And then he adds another point where he says that another thing is that forget about the fact that no one power can be completely in charge. Even what they do, they need to come on to other things. So again, the point is that their power is just much too limited to go ahead and say that these are independent things that deserve some kind of honor. The Yosef then says, what did Rabbi Yochanan ben Karcha mean when he, at the end, brought down that by Esav it says many souls, and by Yaakov it says one soul, which means because Yaakov worships one God and Esav worships many gods. What did he mean to say in that? And that what he meant to say is that this whole idea of that the Jewish people serve one God. The way he says it like this, he says, "Shekol Yisrael liyos taklisam echad l'asharas hanefesh kulam nefesh achas v'ratzon echad." The Jewish people all have one goal. That one goal is eventually to come to a point where we will have an afterlife and be eternally connected to Hashem. It's all about basically Hasharas HaNefesh, he says, an afterlife in which we're all going to be clinging to Hashem. That's our goal. And therefore, we're all one soul because we're all called one soul because we all have one focus. But by those who worship pagan gods, where one guy is looking for riches, and therefore he worships this star. This one's looking for power, and he worships a different star. They're considered many different souls. Meaning, those who are worshiping the pagan gods, each one has his personal goal. Each one has the personal thing that he's trying to get for himself. So they're not all focused on one goal. Each one's focused on himself and what he wants. Therefore, they're not one nefesh, not one soul. They're different souls. Each person has their personal desire, and it's all about getting what they want. And therefore, they are called nefesh souls. The Jewish people, because their goal is one, in being able to eventually come to the point of clinging to Hashem for eternity, they have one goal, therefore they're called one soul. But the whole point is that, according to the way that the Eitz Yosef is learning, is that the answer of Yeshua ben Karcha to his students was the fact that, you know, also similar to like the Marzu, in which he is saying to them, you know, what I said to him can apply to what you're saying too. Because I talked about I brought out the fact that his sons have many gods. And that's the whole point. The idea of many gods, as you're trying to say, well, many gods can make sense, it doesn't make sense. It's not going to work. Because again, if the fact that they have these many gods and these many beliefs in those gods, because they're trying to get to assign power to those gods, it doesn't work out. It doesn't make sense because of the fact that, again, no one of them can be in charge. You can't have so many people in charge, and therefore it's got to be that they're all serving one god. But like his sons are worshiping different gods, you know, and they're trying to assign power to the different gods. Number one, to say one is in charge over everything, that just doesn't make sense. Doesn't work. And even to try to say, well, there's many in charge and therefore they should all be honored, that also doesn't work. But the point is that the idea of what he was trying to bring out by this person's family, of the belief in many gods, that is the answer as to why there's no point to apply the majority to following that. There's no point, because basically the majority is not going to tell you to follow something that doesn't make sense. That's really what, according to the Joseph, he was saying. If it doesn't make sense, then there's no point to the majority, the point of following the majority. Similar to the first answer that we gave, but coming from a different angle. The first answer we gave was, we don't have any doubts about our relationship with Hashem. No doubts, you don't follow the majority. He seems to, my understanding of the Yosef is that he's saying something similar. In the sense of, if the majority is not doing something sensible, then you don't follow it. Right? When you were a kid, and you got into trouble. So your mother said to you, you know, why'd you do this? So he said, well, so-and-so told me to do it. So what would she say to you? And if he tells you to jump off the roof, you're going to jump off the roof? You know, that's the classic discussion. That's what's happening here a little bit. That's what the Yosef is saying here. It makes no sense what they're doing. So the majority is going to say, follow everybody who's doing something nonsensical? So this whole question, so interesting, it's interesting how this question was taken seriously in the sense of that, you know, it brought out something, it brought up a concept from the Torah. And again, as we said from the Marzu, the simplest answer would be that if the Torah only said to follow the majority when it's not in contradiction to the Torah, it would be the simplest answer. But again, you find that others answered it differently. They tried not to just go ahead and make things an exception. They tried actually to answer the question by focusing on what this whole idea of following the majority means. And when does it make sense to do that? Okay. The next thing that I would like to do...
There was last week's conference talking about Yisro Deli Moshe.
Right.
About being, you know, as far as so many people under you,
mm-hmm.
but like you make the last word, even like you said, the general has a president who has the last word.
Okay. But, yeah, in some way that's going to happen, especially amongst people.
Yeah.
Okay, let's look at page 436. And this is, let's take a look starting from Pasuk Yud Zayin. Shalosh Pamim Hashana, three times a year, Yireel Kol Zechorcha, all your males shall appear, El Pnei Adon Hashem, in front of the Master God. This is the mitzvah of Shalosh Regalim. The three times we have a mitzvah to go to Yerushalayim for Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Then it says, "Lisisba kal chametz tav zivchi," that "Lo yolim chelav chagi ad boiker." That means you shall not offer the blood of my feast offering upon leavened bread, nor may the fat of my festive offering remain overnight until morning. Next pasuk, "Reishis b'kori ad matzcha," the first or the best, the choice. Of your first fruits of your land, Tavi, Beis Hashem Elokecha, she will bring to the house of Hashem your God. Do not cook a kid in the milk of its mother. So here is one of the first, this is, there are three times the Torah says this, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. This is the first time. What the Mefarshim seem to be bothered by is just the juxtaposition of this pasuk. Like, you know, where does it come in? All these things seem to be disjointed. What's the connection here? You talk about in the pasuk, first talk about in the pasuk, Bikurim, the mitzvah to bring the first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash to give to the Kayin, and then it says, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, the prohibition of cooking milk and meat together. What's the connection between the two? So the commentary of the Sefornu says a very interesting answer. So he says that the connection is okay. Lo sevashal gadi b'chavei b'moy. Says it's a fornu. Lo yisasu k'moy eila ha'pu'ulois l'harbois ha'peres. Don't do this, meaning don't cook milk and meat together in order to increase the production of your fruits. Kamachshavas anshei hatzava. Tzava is a type of idol worship, and there were the people who worshipped these idols, they believed that if you cook milk and meat together, that's going to increase your fruits. So it says the Torah, don't do that to increase your fruits. But rather bring your first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash. Quotes a pasuk that when you bring to Hashem what you're supposed to, that brings blessing. So according to the Sefornu, the Torah is saying, don't cook milk and meat to increase your fruits as certain idol worshippers did. But rather, you know what you should bring your fruits? Don't do things that idol worshippers do. Bring Bikurim. Do the mitzvah Bikurim. Now the Sefornu is actually now giving us a very, very interesting insight to the prohibition of milk and meat. Like, what's wrong with milk and meat? The answer is, according to Sefornu, that milk and meat was something that certain idol worshippers believed will increase their fruits. And therefore the Torah is trying to tell us, stay away from that. Don't do something, don't even cook it, right? Forget it, don't cook it. They cooked it because they believed that by cooking these two things together, it's going to increase the fruits. Don't follow in what they did. Now, the Sefornu doesn't explain, you know, well, what happened? According to them, you cook milk and meat together and some magic came out of that cooking and whatever. You know, he doesn't explain what it means. But the Sefornu is clearly telling us that the prohibition of milk and meat comes from the fact that cooking milk and meat had some kind of a connection to idol worshippers or idol worship. The Rambam, so I heard in the Rambam Amar Nevuchim, I didn't see it inside, but the Rambam Nevuchim says something similar. But the Rambam Nevuchim sounds like that actually, if you cook milk and meat together and you pour it onto the tree or on the ground, I'm not sure exactly where, that he says it makes sense that it should help the fruits produce better. Makes it sound like it should work. The way he says it is that milk and meat is something, he calls it av, ayin vase, which means thick, dense, not sure exactly what that means, but because it is that, therefore it makes sense that actually it should help fruits grow better. And he says that the practice of idol worshippers or certain idol worshippers on their holiday, meaning when they were celebrating their worship, when they were having a holiday in honor of whatever God they believed in, on their holidays, you know what they would do? They would cook the milk and meat together, and they'd pour it to make the fruits grow better. It was part of their festival. Part of the festival for this God was to do something to make the fruits grow more. That was part of the festival. And what was that thing that they did? They cooked the milk and meat together, and they, I think, believe he says, and they poured it, and they poured it, you know, over the tree or on the ground. And he says that this fits in very well with the fact that the pasuk before starts off with the mitzvah of going shalosh regalim, where the mitzvah is that you're supposed, three times a year you have to celebrate with Hashem at the Beis HaMikdash. So he's saying the connection between that and the prohibition of cooking milk and meat is because cooking milk and meat was part of a pagan holiday, was part of the celebration of Avodah Zarah. No, that's not what you do. You don't worship like that. You go to the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So he's calling it again. It's similar to the Sephardim's idea. But the way he explains it is that it was part of the celebration. Number one, it seems like there is something about cooking milk and meat together that could actually help the fruits grow better. But being that it was part of a the celebration of the idol worshiper celebration, the Torah said don't do it. Now there is a story that's told again about Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz that. Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz, when he would be in the bathroom, and he didn't want to waste time, he was teaching himself German. And he would read German articles, German paper, newspapers. So the story goes that he was once reading an article about how if you cook milk and meat together and you pour it on the tree for like a month, it's going to help you produce the fruits faster. Okay, well when he read that, all of a sudden it popped in his mind how to explain the connection. The Torah says, bring bikurim, don't cook milk and meat. So what the Torah is saying is, you might think that in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah bikurim earlier, I should cook milk and meat together to go ahead and cause it to grow quicker. The Torah says, no, don't do it. Doesn't explain, you know, he's not giving any kind of explanation as to why not to do it, but the connection between bikurim and cooking the milk and meat, the Sephardim says, was to say, if you think cooking milk and meat together is going to bring an increase of your crops, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is in not, don't follow the idol worshippers who did that, but rather do the mitzvah. And Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz, he was making the connection in the sense of the Torah saying, if you want to cook milk and meat together because you want to be able to, you know, bring Bikurim earlier, faster, do the mitzvah earlier than later. No, you can't. You don't cook milk. Don't cook milk and meat in order to do that. But the thing was, he doesn't say because. The thing is that according to this, but the end of the story is, the Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz said to himself, like, Ivey, he just had a Torah thought in the bathroom. So because of that, it says he fasted 40 days, and he, from then on he stopped, you know, he stopped reading things in the bathroom because he was afraid that certain ideas would start causing him using those ideas for Torah. Therefore, he said, you know, no more reading those articles in the bathroom anymore. But it's just very interesting about how, you know, you have these different sources talking about cooking milk and meat together as a means of helping the development of your fruits. That you know, was it just some kind of a, you know, Baba Maisa that the idol worshippers believed in? Which, again, if you read the Sephardim, I think you'd understand it like that. But again, the Rambam explains it actually as something that, again, could work. I can't talk about it now if botanists or, you know, agricultural experts would say there is such a thing or not. But they clearly believed that there was such a thing. And the Rambam said, well, because it was part of the celebration of Avodah Zarah, the Torah says, you can't, don't do it. Now it's interesting because whether you learn the Sephardim or the Rambam, you know, you could have said, well, if that's the reason why not to cook, then maybe the only time it's a problem, then maybe it should only be a problem when you do it for that. You know? Maybe it should only be a problem if you're actually doing it as some kind of idol worship. But then you could say, no, the Torah says, don't do such an act that was part of idol worship. Okay? But again, don't do it can still mean don't do it to help your crops grow. You know, does that mean to say don't do it at all and afterward don't eat it and don't have benefit from it? But again, it could very well be that the Torah, again, since, especially according to the way the Rambam and the Sephardim were saying, that it's all about, we're staying away from cooking milk and meat together because it's all about staying away from something that was part of idol worship. Therefore, the Torah said, like, stay away from it completely. There's no cooking and there's no benefiting, there's no eating from it. Just completely stay away from it because of its connection to idol worship.
The question is, bikurim could be like a metaphor. The bikurim is you, your body, and they're telling you not to have milk and meat in your body, taking the place of the plants, so it's not good for you.
All right, then maybe that's another explanation. Okay. Okay. Now, towards the end of the parsha, you know, we when we think about the giving of the Torah, we have the famous words of when the Jewish people say "Nasa v'nishma," whatever we will do, and we will listen. And actually, that's not in last week's parsha, in Parshas Yisro, in this week's parsha, on page 440, Pasuk Zayin. Vayikach Sefer Habris. Moshe took the book of the covenant. Vayikra Bosnei Ha'am. He read it in the ears of the people. Vayyemu, and they said, Kol Asher Dibra Hashem, whatever Hashem says, Na'aseh V'nishma, we will do and we will listen. This is where it is. So there's a famous question that in last week's Parsha, based on the wording of last week's Parsha, the Gemara in Shabbos says that when the Jewish people were about to receive the Torah, that Hashem raised up the Torah above them. Basically said, accept the Torah, or else I'm dropping this on you, you're done. Which means that Hashem basically had to coerce them to accept the Torah. The question is, all the commentaries ask, what do you mean? They said Na'aseh V'nishma. They said they willingly and wholeheartedly and lovingly accepted the Torah. If that's what they did, then why did Hashem need to coerce them? So the commentary of the Das HaKeinim, the Baal HaTosfos, actually in last week's Parsha, in Parshas Yisrei, you know, brings this question. And the answer that he gives is, okay, so he asks the question, and he gives the following answer. V'yesh leimar. The answer is, and he's quoting a medrash, Kikshiratza HaKadosh Baruch Litein Torah LeYisrael, when Hashem wanted to give the Torah to the Jewish people, Amru Kama Torahs Yesh Lecha. How many Torahs do you have? Amar Lahem, Achas Peksav, Achas Alpeh. One written, one oral. Amru Loi Shebechsav Inu Mekablon. We'll accept the written one. Shabal Pei, you know, the Mekablin. We're not ready to accept the oral. Miyad Kafalem Harkigigas. That's when he picked up the mountain. He said, you don't have a choice. Now he bases this on a medrash. Again, the parentheses here brings, it says, Re'ei Tanchuma Noyach. Look at the Tanchuma in Parshas Noyach. Now, the medrash on Tanchuma in Parshas Noyach, you know, elaborates on, you know, what this means, you know, what does it mean? Why did they not want to accept the Torah Shabbat Peh? Why did they not want to? The Das HaKeinim doesn't bring it down. Now, I think, you know, there's a problem here. We know that there's no real way to understand the written law without the oral law, right? Unless you're a Karaite and you kind of just do your own thing. You know, you can't, there are certain things in the Torah you just can't understand without the Torah Shabbat Peh. There are certain things in the written law you can't understand without the oral law. So what do you mean? We accept the written law, not the oral law. You can't do the written law without the oral law. So therefore, what were they saying? So I think I heard this explanation once before. I can't remember where. Or at least explanation to the whole thing. And that is that I don't think that they were, you know, the parts of Torah Shabbat Peh, the parts of the oral law that explain the written law, they understood they have to accept that or else they're not going to know the written law. They understood that. What bugged them about the oral law were what we call takanas derabbanan, the enactments of the rabbis. In Torah Shabbat Peh, the rabbis have a lot of control. They, besides the interpretations that they make, they have the power to enact rabbinic law. That's part of Torah Shabbat Peh. That the rabbis enacted their rabbinic laws, their rabbinic decrees, and were obligated to follow that. And that's what they were bugged with. They weren't so happy about the idea of the fact that they're going to have to, that the rabbis are going to be able to really be in control of the whole situation like that. Because to have such power means we're really going to be subservient to the rabbis and their interpretations. And that's not something they were ready to accept upon themselves. Now, here again, the Das HaKeinim doesn't bring this down, but the Gemara in Shabbos says that, yes, they were coerced, and for a period of time, the Jewish people could have turned around and said, you know, we were coerced into this. generations later, they could say, our ancestors were coerced. But when Purim came and they experienced the Purim miracle, the Gemara says, that's when again they reaccepted everything wholeheartedly. Which, if you follow this interpretation, it means that something about Purim made them reaccept or willingly accept the Torah Shabbat Peh, the Oral Law. And according to the way I'm saying now, the explanation is, if the whole problem that the Jewish people had was accepting, that they had to accept what the sages said, the Purim story showed them how smart the sages are. Because Mordechai was telling them from the beginning, don't go to Paro's party. Whatever Mordechai told them, this is the wrong way to go, and they wouldn't accept what he said. And after everything happened, they realized he was right. And after everything that happened, they realized not only he was right, he was the means by which, him and Esther were the means by which to bring about the miracle. It means that they gained an insight that, yeah, we should be listening to the Chachamim. We should be listening to the sages. We should be willing to listen to them even when we don't understand. Our ancestors weren't willing to be so dedicated. They weren't ready to be so subservient to the sages. But it was the story of Purim that made them appreciate the Chachamim. It made them appreciate the Chachamim because they saw that Mordechai was right the whole time. The sage, he was the one who was right. So therefore, when they saw how Mordechai was right, that gave them the insight that yes, they should be agreeing, they should accept willingly the part of Torah Shabbat Peh where the Chachamim can make their takanas, they can institute their laws. So the problem really was that part of Torah Shabbat Peh is the fact that the sages, the Chachamim, have so much power. From the story of Purim, they saw how much that power makes sense to follow. And therefore, again, they willingly accepted the Torah Shabbat Peh after the Purim miracle.